hello there, and welcome to episode 9 of the Creepy Kingdom podcast, a podcast all about the creepiness of the Disney films and theme parks. I am your host, Mr. James H. Carter II. Coming up in this episode, I am joined by director Philip Swift. He is the director of The Bubble, a documentary about Celebration, Florida. And if you don't know what Celebration, Florida is, let me tell you, it's a town, a residential town built on Walt Disney World property. And things aren't always as they seem there. So he's going to come on and tell us all about that. Just a heads up, if you have any children listening with you, you might want to turn it off and come back later. While there is no profanity on the show, because this is a clean rated show, there's some brief discussion of some bad things that sometimes happen in the world and that have happened in Celebration, Florida. So you might not want to open that can of worms around your kids. It's your call. Just wanted to give you a heads up on that. So, enough jibber jabber. Let's get to it. Right now, I'm joined by Philip Swift, the documentary filmmaker of the documentary The Bubble, a documentary film about Celebration. Just said documentary 3 times in a row. Anyways, welcome to the show, Philip.
Yeah, thanks, James. This is an honor to be here. I'm excited to be a part of it. I really feel like Celebration Florida fits into the creepiness of Walt Disney World.
Yeah, I thought so too. That's why I was interested in your documentary, and that's why I wanted to have you on, so we could dive a little deeper into that. I guess before we even get started going down that rabbit hole, why don't we talk a little bit about what Celebration Florida is, in case any listeners don't know.
Sure. The first time I ever heard about Celebration, I guess even before that, I grew up in Ohio, in Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And it was what we did for our vacations every year. So we went to Walt Disney World. My mom loved Walt Disney World. I always say that we weren't really raised with religion, but we prayed to the altar of Disney.
Okay.
And so literally it was like it was like our pilgrimage to Mecca every year was going to Walt Disney World. It's so silly, but it's true. And in 1994, I would have been about 14 years old. We were... For some reason, my mom had heard about Celebration. Like that's like when the ground was broken and they were starting to build the town. And she has said, like, I gotta go look at this town. I gotta see what's going on. This seems like a dream. Mm. And so we drove through this basically what was a construction site at the time, and they had like one like model house built. It wasn't anything fancy, but we drove through, and my mom was just hypnotized. She loved it. She was like, "This is it. This is where I want to be one day."
Wow.
And I just was like, "What is this? This is nothing. This is weird." And I didn't really think about it again until around, I guess it was around 2011, or maybe 2010, I forget the exact date, but the news reports that started coming out about the first murder that happened in the Disney-built town. Time, that would have been probably like the, 13th or 14th anniversary of the town itself.
Wow. Well, let's take a step back before we go from there. I think we skipped
over things. Sure. Oh, yeah. So what is Celebration? That's a good idea. Right.
Yeah,
just, don't give it away yet.
Yeah, because I think the thing you skipped is that this is a town that is on Walt Disney World property.
Definitely. Okay, so yeah, so Celebration Florida is literally in the southwestern corner of Walt Disney World. So they actually had this little space of land, and Michael Eisner and some other people at the time who were running Disney, they wanted to sort of expand the park, but do it in a different way, not just put another, theme park like Magic Kingdom or Epcot or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so when they started to think, well, what can we do with that area, somebody went back and looked at the original plans for Epcot that Walt Disney had. And he, it was the last thing that he was really planning before he died, was this idea that he wanted to make this experimental prototype community of tomorrow, which is, of course, Epcot. And so he had this, when he had this idea, it was this crazy, like, super futuristic, like, insane, like, giant steel and glass buildings, and all the transportation would be underground, and people who, like, lived there would also be working in Disney, and they would be sharing, like, their knowledge and their passions with the community in order to, like, make a better, wonderful society. And then he died, and they kind of, like, shelved the idea for Epcot. And it wasn't until the theme park that we know as Epcot Center opened that idea even was. And it was really, it wasn't the idea that Disney had. It was they took the idea and kind of like attached it to a theme park idea. So that's what Epcot Center is like. And so when the Disney board was looking to build this town, they took some of the ideas that Walt had talked about in this idea, like a couple like futuristic, quote-unquote,
right,
things that they did with Celebration was they put all of the power lines underground. They built it from the ground up with, like, a fiber optic telecommunications network, like, built into the town and everything. And they built it as this, you know, wonderful, walkable city. And it was actually town's a better term for it, but Celebration then became, instead of making it this super futuristic thing, they decided they wanted to make it almost like a town that Walt Disney would have grown up in, Walt Disney himself would have grown up in. So it's this classic, like, Americana kind of, you know, good down-home kind of vibe that they built, they manufactured. And we all know that Disney, being these, like, architects of the happiest place on Earth, there's no reason why they couldn't build a perfect town and have it succeed successfully. But as we know, as time went on, it didn't do as well as they thought it would.
Okay. So, what do you think the real reason that they actually built the town was? Just, like, why did they want to bring, you know, residential zones into Walt Disney World?
It seems to me like they felt like they probably had reached, they had Epcot, they had, MGM Studios, they had, of course, the Magic Kingdom and Animal Kingdom, and they probably thought, like, okay, what else could we do? We've kind of done everything as far as theme parks are concerned. And I think it was sort of, and so I think it kind of partly, in my interpretation, had to do with Michael Eisner's, like, hubris. Like, he really wanted to try to do something completely different that hadn't been seen before. And what's interesting about the Celebration plan is that it started as a really small-scale thing. It was supposed to be only 50 homes. They were going to do 50 homes, have this small little community, and then maybe expand if it was successful. But all of the Disney fans in the world that, like, love Disney World and are going there 3-4 times a year, they heard about it, and immediately, like, all those first 50 homes were, like, bought instantly. So the second they could go on sale, they were all bought. And for, like, a, you know, 500% markup or some crazy amount. And before they even let people move in, while they're still doing the final construction on those 50 homes, they decided to expand to 500 homes. And the crazy thing about the expansion is that they didn't even bring in any more construction crews. They just said to these, you know, crews that were building these 50 homes, they said, you should go ahead and build another, you know, 450 of them.
Wow.
And so they had, like, a really, really shoddy construction going on in this place. They were, you know, people were that were supposed to be doing, like, you know, drywall ended up doing carpeting, and people that were supposed to be doing electrician work were, like, putting on roofs. And so the first, like, batch of homes that were built were very, very shoddy. Somebody even wrote, like, a little pamphlet for the residents. One of the residents wrote it for the residents about how to survive, like, your first month at Celebration, because it's so many problems. So yeah, I don't know what their goal was. It seems crazy, because the biggest thing they ran into too was that, of course, like, Magic Kingdom is pristine, and it's clean, it's perfect, and because they have crews of people going through every night to, like, change every light bulb that needs to be changed and pick up all the gum and do whatever, and but a town is not the same thing. The town doesn't have a crew of people that is coming through and, like, cleaning everything. So when things weren't met to, like, when the residents that were moving in, it didn't have that Disney polish they were hoping from a town, they quickly became upset. And they fixed it. Everything got, the truth of it is that everything got fixed in the long run, but there in the beginning, things were definitely kind of wacky.
Sounds like they were riding by the seat of their pants on running a town.
Yeah. Well, imagine like you. Yeah, imagine if your entire experience is like running this theme park where people come and have fun, and then they go home at the end of the day, and then those same people were like, okay, now let's build a town. Like they put all of the same ideas into it that a theme park would have or theme park construction, but but there were like certain things they didn't consider. They were like, oh, well, maybe these people want to live here. We should consider where like the drainage is going to go off of the houses, you know. People's lawns were getting flooded because they had like faux gutters on the front of their houses.
One of the first thoughts I had about this is the first time I heard about Celebration was it was a bus driver. It wasn't one of the property bus drivers. It was a private, I guess it was private. I was going to a wedding that was at Epcot that was before it was open. So that we had to take a bus to be brought in the back because before World Showcase opens later in the day. excuse me. So anyway, so they were all, we had to wait for a while. So the bus driver felt the need to start throwing some trivia our way. And so then he starts telling us about, you know, Celebration. And I had never heard of that. And this is in 2009. And I'd never heard anything about it, and I became a little bit fascinated by it because I was like, oh, well, this is the predecessor to what Walt Disney had planned, you know, as Epcot to be. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I, you know, got home and what, you know, started researching about it, I was like, this is nothing like Epcot. just from the way it's presented, not even digging below the surface. It resembles mostly the Main Street USA kind of design and look.
I was just gonna say, yeah, it's funny that they did that. I think they looked at the marketability of the original plan of Epcot, and they were like, well, it's, you know, 1994 when we were building this town,
right.
And people maybe. We could probably get some people moving into this like futurist. I would rather live in a crazy like weird fascist futuristic society than 1950s America. For as much as we want to romanticize the 50s, it was also a pretty terrible time.
Oh, definitely. Well, that's the way we romanticize is because that's the way it was portrayed in the mainstream media with television and whatever. It was kind of the opposite of reality.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's strange because if they had done something like the original Epcot, I think that it, I don't know if they would have been able to maintain it, but I think that would have been very successful because like you said, most people would, eccentric people and also very wealthy people would want to be there. So when I found out that this was not that and that it just kind of looked like any other town, and I'm like, what is the point? Like, what, just to say that you live on Disney property? Like, so I guess my question is, in your opinion on this, of course, since you didn't move there, is why not just live off property for way less money, you know, like around the corner or down the street?
There is something about, and they talk about it in the documentary, several people, they talk about how, like, well, it's Disney. Like, you know, you get to say you live in Disney. Like, Disney built this town, and it's wonderful. So even if it had been, like, you know, cardboard boxes in the street, they still would have been like, but it's Disney. It's great. Don't you see? It's great. I think there's been a lot of, this is a random, not really random, it's connected, obviously. But there's been a lot of analysis recently of, like, looking at Microsoft and looking at Apple and looking at, like, their lack of innovation after their CEO step down or pass away in the case of Steve Jobs. So you lose guidance from Bill Gates, you lose guidance from Steve Jobs, and then what happens is it becomes this corporate thing where they just need to please the shareholders, and all innovation is pushed aside.
Right.
And I think that's what we see with Disney. I think we definitely see it with Disney. Walt Disney had this crazy dream and crazy passion, and while he was alive, he was pushing constantly to get it to be the reality that he saw in his head. But when other people took over, they didn't have the same drive, the same passion, the same need to innovate. And what we see is things like Epcot Center, which in the beginning was supposed to be this big, you know, even for what it was, for the theme park was Epcot Center, it was still supposed to be this sort of educational, futuristic space. But the current iteration of Epcot Center is no longer called Epcot Center, even.
Right.
It's just called Epcot, and it doesn't actually mean anything anymore. It's the same thing I think we see with Celebration. If it was supposed to be this sort of like continuation of Walt's dream or a grafting of his dream onto this other idea, it lacks the innovation and it lacks the inspiration that like a true like pioneer, a true innovator would give to it, you know?
Right. No.
But people are happy, you know. It has a lot to do. I think on some level, people. I don't think they would admit it, but I think it has a lot to do with buyer's remorse. Like you buy something you know, you buy this house for so much money, and you're like, but you know, it's great. It's the best thing ever. Look at it. Like you know, maybe this door is falling off, and maybe we live across the street from you know one of the biggest like you know prescription drug pill farms in Florida. Like Kissimmee is not a good neighbor necessarily to have.
But they
live in their own little, as the film is titled, bubble,
right?
And they think it's great. This is another side thing, but something that wasn't touched on in the film, but we talked about it a lot when we were making it with the residents, that the bubble idea is further you know examined when you think about how the town itself, the town of Celebration, you could live and die there, like, and never have to leave, all right? They have a hospital where you could be born, they have a school you could go to, K through 12, they have a Stetson University branch, so you could actually go and get a college degree, and they have a whole industrial complex where you could get a job, but, you know, software engineering, or you could work at the local Starbucks if you want, it's all inside of Celebration. And then you could get married in one of the churches. You could give birth to, you know, your child in the hospital, and you could be cremated. Actually, in one of the, they have four or five different churches of different denominations throughout Celebration, and one of them actually has a crematorium. So you could then be cremated and have your ashes, you know, spread over the lake there in the middle of town. The only thing you have to leave the bubble, quote unquote, for. Is gas and food. And when I say food, I mean groceries. Wow. So they have restaurants. Yeah, you could live and live your whole life eating Thai food and Japanese food and whatever, but if you want to actually get groceries, you got to leave. You got to leave the bubble.
That seems like a major flaw there. Gas and food seem pretty...
Yeah, especially in Florida. Like, the town was built to be this walkable town, but every single person drives. Like, they still drive, and you see some people walking around every now and then. For the most part, people are still driving, like, all over. They promote using these, what they call NEVs, N-E-Vs, which are neighborhood electronic vehicles, or electric vehicles. And so they're basically, like, go-karts or golf carts.
Oh, okay.
That they drive around, and it have, you know, zero emissions and stuff like that. So that's a little bit better, but... Why aren't you just walk? It's a beautiful town. You paid all this money to be in. Go for a walk.
How many square miles is Celebration?
I don't actually know. I'm looking at the map right now, and off the top of my head, I can't think. But the wonderful people over at Wikipedia could probably tell us.
Right.
So I'll actually pull that up while we're chatting.
Right. Real-time research.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's interesting also in the film. One of the guys talks about it. How the way the town is designed, he believes, was designed to thwart burglars.
Really?
Because it's a very confusing layout. And I spent about 2 weeks in Celebration. I was there in April of 2011 for about 4 or 5 days, and then I went back again in November of 2011, and it. Is very confusing. It took me after spending, you know, 2 weeks there, didn't really get a feeling for it all.
Wow.
I'm sure eventually I would. According to what I'm looking at now on Wikipedia, it is 10.7 square miles. And as of 2010, the population is 7,400 people.
So you don't need a car. You could get around, especially with those vehicles.
Yeah, you know
they're talking about. But groceries,
or hop on a bike.
Bike, of course, but groceries—that's a tough one. You know, that's you got to.
Yeah,
maybe they'll deliver them in. I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
When you were shooting those days, did you actually stay in Celebration? And like, were you in the bubble for 4 or 5 days?
The first time in April of 2011, I teach filmmaking in public schools here in New York. So one of the joys of that is that I have that kind of public school schedule calendar kind of thing.
Right.
So I get to have the glorious spring break off. And around in 2011, my spring break was coming, and my wife said to me, "You know, what are you going to do? You're going to have a week off." And she actually conveniently had time off too at the time. And she said, "We should do something." And I was like, "Eh, let's just stay home and catch up on TV or whatever." And she said, "Well, you've been reading a lot about Celebration Florida and about the things that have been going on there, which we can get into a little bit later because that's the really creepy part." But
right, of course.
She said, "We should go down. We should go down and visit." And talk to people, and then I was like, yes, definitely, we should definitely do that. So I thank my wife for giving me the kick in the pants to do it, and I started emailing people in the town. Teaching filmmaking in schools helped because I was able to like reach out to the school to start with, because they have a K through 8 elementary school and then a high school, and I tapped in with the principal and the drama teacher there, and they were really happy. And I pitched it actually as I could come and like do a presentation at the school about, you know, being an independent artist in New York and teaching, you know, filmmaking in public schools and everything. So that was cool. And then I got to interview the drama teacher and the principal, and then just through other random Google searches, I found you know, people through the Chamber of Commerce and. A couple other, like, you know, one other business guy who designs like apps, iPhone apps for Celebration, and so all these people were really happy. They were very open to talk about it. What was interesting in that first round of interviews, though, is that every single person was trying to sell me something. Like, the principal was trying to sell me the quality of education, and this guy was trying to sell me like tech stock or something. I don't know. And the Chamber of Commerce people were just trying to like get a free ad, you know, in a movie. And it wasn't until when that was done, I came back and did a Kickstarter, and so then it was out there in the world that I was making this movie, that's when people started emailing me, I started getting people that were like, "Yeah, oh, I've got a story that would pop that bubble," like, you know, things like that. And they felt like they really needed to be in the movie, so that was cool, because for the second trip that was 10 days, it really. Expanded the scope of people I was talking to. But to answer your question, so the first time in April for those 4 or 5 days, we stayed with my wife's grandmother, so my grandmother-in-law, we stayed with her, she lives in Wildwood, Florida, which was just kind of down the road from Disney.
Okay.
And then that was for the first half, and then we actually stayed at the Mona Lisa Suites in Celebration, Florida for a couple nights, which is there, has more of like a, you know, built in like a little kitchenette in every room and stuff like that. So that was cool. It was nice to be able to like really be in the bubble. But then to save some money, when I was there in November, I went with a friend of mine who's a cinematographer. He and I stayed literally across the street from the entrance at like this Radisson. And it was just like for 10 days that we were there, they gave us a really good deal.
Oh, okay.
And it was nice. It was refreshing being there in town, like in Celebration. It was nice to be able to step out outside and go home there every night. But it was we were there for 10 solid days, and by the 10th day, like we couldn't go back. Like that was the 10th day is when we went and got all of the footage of Kissimmee. There's that whole section in the film just about Kissimmee, with a bunch of B-roll of like the weird, like dilapidated tourist attractions there. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did the whole last day, because we couldn't take another day in that town.
Well, you kind of touched on one of my next questions is, what, and you can talk about both phases of shooting, what did the participants think about, what did they think your angle was? Like, you know, did they think he was a negative, a positive, or... Like, why were they willing to talk to you, basically?
So I always pitched it from day one that I had a filmmaking teacher in art school who said, if you're going to make a documentary, make sure it's something you are interested in, like something that mm-hmm. you want to learn more about, which kind of makes sense, kind of obvious.
Right.
And that's really what started this whole project, is that I was really curious about the origin of Celebration and what was going on in Celebration. And so, of course, there was a murder that happened there that got, you know, international headlines because of it. You know, Disney Town has first murder and things like that. And that was definitely why people probably wanted to talk about Celebration at first, or why the world wanted to hear about Celebration. But when you get in the town, of course, they want to kind of tell you other things. So the people initially were a little bit suspicious. We had, I hadn't thought of a title yet for the film, and so with the first week that I was there with my wife, we had like just really simple, basic business cards made that said like Celebration USA, a documentary film, and they had like my name and email and stuff, so I could hand them out to people. And had I done a little more research, I would have realized that there was actually a New York Times reporter who wrote a book, a really scathing book about Celebration called Celebration USA.
Oh, wow.
And so everyone thought that, all the residents thought that I was like making a documentary of this book, and they immediately didn't trust me. So that was funny. We had several people, they were like, no, get away. But at the end of the day, most people were happy to talk. Even if they were suspicious, they were happy to talk to me because they wanted to convince me that it was a good place, that it was a completely good place. And maybe I was brainwashed, I don't know, but at the end of the day, it's not that terrible of a place. You know, my wife and I would leave interviews that we did with people, and we wouldn't talk for like 5 or 10 minutes as we were like driving away. Mm. And then eventually one of us would always say like, oh, that's not so bad. It's okay. We can live here. Because if you do look at the things that people see as like bad, like of course, okay, it was run by a corporation, you know, Disney, and it actually still is run by a corporation, but a different one. Disney sold its rights to a company called Lexan about 10 years into the experiment, if we want to call it that. Mm-hmm. So it is still this corporate run town. The people do have a say. There's a whole like development community board that. Majority of people on that board are residents, but the thing about it is that, you know, you live in New Jersey, I live in New York. Like these places are also like bad. Like things happen, people get murdered, like much more than in Celebration, Florida. The drug scene is worse. You know, education's terrible. And at the end of the day, you know, Celebration is a bunch of people. Most people that live there are there for what they believe is a good reason. They think that they're there to like promote this sense of family, the sense of like classic Americana, like wholehearted goodness.
Yeah.
But what we're starting to see in the town, which is kind of in some ways connects back to that idea of what I was saying with like Walt Disney or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, is that we're getting into the second or third generation of people living in Celebration that don't have the same passion that those initial pioneers, as they call themselves, they don't have the same passion. These kids, so kids are being raised now and are completely out of the bubble now, and they almost every first generation or second generation rather resident of Celebration that I talked to said they would never move back. They were like, no, this place is weird. I'm done with it. I want to go out. But then what's funny about that is that you talk to anybody. You talk to any teenager when they're done with high school. And
right. They want to get out of town.
Yeah. It's funny to me, living in New York and like teaching in New York, like my entire life I was raised like thinking like, oh, New York City, that's like where everybody goes to do whatever. And everyone's trying to get there.
Yeah.
But almost every teenager I talk to is like, get me out of here. Like, I want to go somewhere else and do something else. And I'm tired of living in New York. So we talked to, yeah, a lot of people we talked to are kind of fed up with the thing. And one of the people we talked to, a younger kid who was graduating high school, he was like, yeah, death sentence. I'm giving this place a death sentence. It's not going to be around in 10 years. Like,
really?
It's going to quickly dry up. And yeah, which I don't think, I don't know, Disney's not going to let that happen. Because even if they don't have a controlling, they don't have a controlling stake in the town anymore, but they do have the right to come in at any time and say like, no, we don't agree with that, or we don't agree with this. They still have veto options for anything. So if the town was like just turned into like a giant 7,000 person like, you know, meth lab, I think Disney would come in and do something about it.
It's still on their property. They just hired some other company to run it, right? To manage.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And they're still now, and they're going through a debate now about whether or not they should become an incorporated town. Because technically they are just a large subdivision within Kissimmee, even though they are on Disney property and, you know, all that stuff, it's still technically a part of Kissimmee. So there's a debate going on amongst the residents about whether or not they should, whether or not they should incorporate as their own town. And then it's something that I think Osceola County in Florida wants them to do, because then more of their individual taxes would go into the community. but then some of the townsfolk don't want that to happen, of course, and it's just an interesting time for that town to see what's going to happen next.
Well, isn't most of Walt Disney World property, it's a lot of it's in Kissimmee, I think, but very little of it is actually in Orlando city limits, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know all the specifics, but yeah, that's definitely true.
So yeah, there's a lot of towns going in and out of there, which I'm sure it's interesting for taxes or whatever. I don't know if it's if it's all the same county or not, but
right.
You know, political BS that I don't usually pay attention to, I'm sure.
yeah. Definitely.
All right, so I want to reference this this article that you wrote here, which was the 8 strange things about the Disney built town of Celebration, Florida.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I thought that was a great breakdown. Now, I'm not going to go through all of them because we want to, you know, leave some goodies for people to watch if they haven't seen it.
Sure.
So the first one here off the bat, which we've mentioned several times, is murder. So what? So what was that about? What was the murdering going on?
So
in
this
Celebration?
This is really crazy. What's crazy? The craziest thing about it, and that it proves that I am still learning about the craft of documentary filmmaking, is that so initially this murder happened. This guy was found bludgeoned to death in his own apartment. He was a man living by himself, he was bludgeoned with an axe. Specifically, he was bludgeoned because he wasn't, like, butchered with an axe. He was bludgeoned. And they caught the guy who did it, and the guy confessed and everything. But in the confession, the guy said that he had been propositioned by the gentleman who lived in Celebration, had been sexually propositioned, and the guy was homophobic. The murderer was very homophobic and became enraged at the proposition and found this axe in the apartment and bludgeoned him with it. And that was it. That's all that the initial story was. And it was very, you know, creepy and weird. And every single person I talked to had a different, like, you know, interpretation of what happened. Like, literally everybody I talked to was like, oh, no, he was a great guy. You know, it's really sad. Or the next person would be like, well, you know, he was like, he was on Craigslist all the time finding young men to come do yard work, and then he would molest them or have consensual sex or whatever.
A lot of rumors.
And every single person had a different story.
Yeah.
Right, and that's again, it's interesting to see. I think at the end of the day, that's the big thing about the film is that it's just this rumor mill. Like, you talk to anybody, it goes with anywhere. You talk to a wide swath of you know, different people, and they're all going to tell you something different. My point with the film was to keep it this sort of objective, like, oral history of the town. So I didn't try that hard to, like, really investigate the murder. I wanted it to be more about the people's perspective of what happened rather than me do some sort of, like, investigatory, like, you know, story about what really happened. Months later, after I started making the film, right when I was about to release it, I think, it came out that the guy who was murdered actually had a 30-year history of pedophilia across the United States. Like, he had moved from, like, town to town to town, and, like, once, like, a little fire got lit under him, he moved to another town to get away from the accusations that were popping up. And then people started coming out. There was a great article on the Daily Beast about this young man who came out and was like, yeah, we totally, like, my parents let me go to South America with him. We did everything while we were there. And that was a consensual thing, but also with an underage person. So, like, you know,
jeez. Yeah.
And so the guy had this history of things. And so what actually, then the story became a little more, clear was that the guy who was murdered, basically had met this guy before, the guy who killed him, had met him before and had him come over to his house to do some work and everything, and he gave him a drink that had been drugged, and then the murderer, he woke up, and the guy who he killed was on top of him.
Oh, wow.
And had taken his shoes off also. And so the guy woke up and was, like, freaked out and threw the guy off of him. And there happened to be a closet right next to it, which he just opened up to, like, find his shoes, thinking they might be in there. And the closet was filled with shoes. There were, like, dozens of shoes in this closet. And so the guy grabbed one of the shoes and like used the shoelaces on him to strangle the man. And then there also happened to be an axe in the back of the shoe closet, which he grabbed. And then while the guy was like you know, almost dead from suffocation from being strangled, he bludgeoned him with an axe. Wow. So it's creepy how like the story, like the story itself is creepy, but then like when it, the more and more that came out about it, it got creepier and creepier and creepier. And then it's creepy. I look back at the footage, the interviews I did with people, and certain people were like, no, that guy was great. He was wonderful. And who knows what he was saying to the public, but right. You know, you got to wonder if, you know, they were, people were connected, you know, aiding and abetting a known pedophile, who knows? So totally creepy.
Yeah, definitely. Let's move on. Yeah. Let's move on from that one.
Yeah.
So we don't get too creeped out. The next one you had there was swingers. That's a very
swingers.
One.
Yeah. A little more lighthearted, I guess. the swingers, it was interesting because then that came out. The Daily Mail, in which is, you know, not necessarily a very reputable newspaper, but the Daily Mail in England put an article out. And this is actually a great little interesting tidbit that I did find some information about. They put this article out that there was, while they went to do a little story about the murder that happened, somebody was quoted as saying, I'd never met so many swingers until I moved to Celebration, Florida.
Wow.
And it became this thing. All of a sudden, it became a story that, like, oh, wow, you know, these people living in this Disney town, this wonderful town, are just hooking up with everybody constantly all the time. And it completely blew out of proportion. And the swingers segment, like, my film is broken into like 12 or 13 chapters, and the swingers chapter is actually one of my favorite because it's not actually at all about swingers. It's about this like gossip mill, this rumor mill that happens in a small town. Like, because every single person we talked to had a different, like, well, yeah, no, they were, there was a group of golfers who met and they would call themselves the swingers because they swung golf clubs. You know,
wow.
and then people got wind of it, so then they made like jackets that said the Swingers Club on it. But you know, and then other people were like, no, I went to a party and there was a blow up doll, and everyone was like, you know, getting ready to get down with each other, and I left, and then I went home and talked to my my high school kid, and he said, oh, mom, it's Friday night, it's Swingers night, don't you know that?
Wow.
So everybody had a different portrayal of the swingers. So then the interesting thing though is that I actually met the person who was quoted in the article saying, I never met so many swingers until I moved to Celebration, Florida. And the second I met him, he was just this like really dry wit British guy. And he was just like, yeah, like I say like that all the time and people know I'm kidding. But obviously you take one thing out of context and it sounds like I'm being serious.
Right.
So he was completely 100% joking and it blew up from there. So, but then, you know, I did talk to people that had these stories that were like, well, yeah, I went to this house and there was this blow up doll and everyone was having a great time. You know, and other, like the teenagers, wow. If you talk to them, they're like, oh yeah, like people get crazy. Like they were doing crazy stuff all the time. So no 100% proof about swingers. The first time I went with my wife over that spring break, we did, and end up at like one of these little like restaurant kind of private club things in Celebration, because this realtor, I had to, one of the initial searches I did was Celebration real estate because I wanted to talk to somebody about that, and this realtor woman invited us to dinner at this, or for a drink at this like little private club, and it was really creepy because it was like two well-to-do couples. The one gentleman was very drunk and like kept like making very lewd comments to my wife.
Wow.
And it was just, again, you know, it was creepy. It was super creepy. And we both left, like, with a really bad taste in our mouth from that. So, but no definitive proof. No definitive
okay.
proof.
Well, this next one is even way more lighthearted, which is Snope.
Snope is my favorite thing. I love it. The sad truth is that I actually haven't experienced Snope yet. We were there at the, let me think, right before Thanksgiving, and it's the day after Thanksgiving that they start the Snope. And so Snope is this fake snow soap substance that every hour on the hour in the evening between the day after Thanksgiving and up to Christmas Day, they spray it into the air over the town square. And everybody comes out, and it's a wonderful thing, but it's also this disgusting, like, soapy stuff that gets really gross and dirty, and if you, like, try to catch it on your tongue, it just tastes like soap. And it's crazy. It's very funny to me. We have a great segment in the film where this woman who grew up in Celebration, but now actually lives in New York, she used to work in, like, one of the stores there, and she has this great story about how when they initially started the Snope, they would spray it out, and the machines that sprayed it out were so loud that they didn't know what to do, so they had music playing, and they just turned the music up even louder. Oh, so wow. Apparently if you go and see, it's just like this cacophony of like snow machines spraying Snope, and then music blasting, and then kids just getting filthy in this like fake snow stuff. But thankfully, my landlord who here in New York, who's a really good friend of mine, she has family in Orlando, and was going to visit them over the holidays. And I said, hey, if I give you this flip cam, can you go and like film some Snope footage?
Oh, okay. Nice.
And so the animated GIF that you see on the BuzzFeed article is from her footage that ended up in the film all about Snope. And it's this like chubby little kid on this, like, they set up this fake ice rink that is basically nothing more than like a thick plastic, almost like cutting board.
Oh, okay.
And they have these kids go out on these skates, and they like, it's terrible because you can't really ice skate on it, and so they provide these little like PVC pipe walkers. And so this little kid is like trying to skate around, and he literally says on camera, you can hear him say it, he says, I hate this.
Yeah, I remember that when I was watching it.
And it's great, it's hilarious, and like I wish I had caught that, but no, it was my landlord and her son who filmed that stuff, and it's just amazing that they got it. Like, it's one of those like just amazing moments.
Yeah,
Snope is a weird thing.
Is that the same stuff that they use in the theme parks, or do you not know?
I think it is. Yeah, I assume it probably has the same formula makeup.
Right.
It's probably all giving those people cancer, and they just don't know it yet.
Yeah, don't swallow the Snope, guys.
Yeah.
So I have some thoughts about Celebration. You know, before I heard about it, I was like, oh man, I could live at Disney World. That's awesome. You know, like, you know, hypothetically, it would be like, that's something that would be cool to do. And after watching this, I definitely don't feel that way for a number of reasons. One, it's just kind of, it's not too different from, you know, around where I live here in New Jersey. I mean, it's not maybe.
Sure.
The first thing when I think about living in Walt Disney World, like some type of residential housing there, that is that I would want to live in a themed area. Like, that's what I'd be paying the premium for. Something extraordinary, you know, over the top.
Yeah. I would prefer. If Disney World was set up more like, I'm sorry, if Celebration was set up more like the Magic Kingdom, where like here is like Tomorrowland, the neighborhood, and here is Fantasyland, the neighborhood, that would be to me much more pleasing if I was going to live in a Disney town. The way that they did kind of connect that kind of, you know, fantasy world is that there are certain neighborhoods in Celebration that are based on different areas of the country. So there is like the architecture of the houses are definitely like, when you move in there, you can't just build a house. Like, you have, there's a book that you look through, and there's like, you know, 8 or 10 different styles of houses with like 5 or 6 different levels of housing. You can, everything from a small apartment to a single family home to like a giant mansion. But they all fall in line to either like, you know, the New England style of home, or like a Savannah, Georgia style of home, or a West Coast kind of like, you know, more like Adobe kind of style home. So there's a little bit of variety, but only from what they tell you. So it's again this sort of like structured, organized like idea of fun and fantasy that Disney's so good at. Like, you know, you can be a kid again, but only if you follow our rules. Only if you, you know, which is interesting actually, because just to talk about this for a second, because it's really early. But that brings me to the next documentary. Actually, I'm starting on. I've shot 2 interviews for it. There's a guy named Leonard Kinsey who wrote a really interesting book called The Dark Side of Disney.
Oh yeah,
are you familiar with
him? Yeah, we're very familiar with him and his work. Yes.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So actually, last weekend I went to visit him. And we've been talking for a long time now about the idea I pitched to him is that it would be like an adaptation of the book, a documentary adaptation of the
really?
Book.
Really? Wow.
So I interviewed him last weekend, and we're going to interview other people that are featured in the book that like try to, the idea is that it's, I think it's looking at Disney World, and he says it really well in the book too, that it's, you know, he loves Disney World and he's a huge Disney fan. He's just tired of being treated like a kid. So he wants to be able to go and like drop acid and get on Space Mountain, or go and, you know, just get super drunk, or go and do like whatever he wants to do, like figure out the best way to have fun at Disney World as a mature adult. And he's not, of course, he's not alone in that. So there's a bunch of people that try to find these alternative ways to have fun at Disney World because they're tired of being said, like, this is how you have fun, now go have fun. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole group of people that I'm talking to that, like, love to, like, get on the rides, like, what they call, you know, the dark rides. And they love to jump off the ride and, like, sneak around behind the scenes and, like, mess around with the animatronics and then, you know, get back on the ride before anyone notices. So it's interesting to me as like a somebody who was raised going to Disney and definitely felt the, you know, the complacency of it as I got older and older. It's funny to me that there is this group of people out there who love Disney so much but are tired of the routine of it. So they're molding it a different way. It's really fun. Yeah. So we were going to be interviewing a bunch of people that love Disney as an adult, and then my cinematographer, Joe Spitt, who worked with me on The Bubble, he and I are going to go and look at the book as a series of challenges, see if we can achieve the things he sets out. You know, so can we get like a cheap hotel room? Can we you know, can we, you know, sneak into the utilidors that go under Disney? All these different things. You know, what is it? Can we document ourselves high on mushrooms going on Space Mountain? You know, 15 times. So it's good. It's very exciting. It's very early. Very, very. This is, you know, years down the line still probably, but the ball is rolling.
Wow, this is definitely a scoop here. I've never heard anything about this anywhere. So I guess
there was one. We did a screening of The Bubble in I forget when it was now. Several months ago in Philadelphia, just like kind of a random. It was in July, I think. A random screening. I figured I wanted to kind of start get it out there. And the sad thing is that we like rented this really nice space, and we were expecting people to come, and it cost a little bit of money to rent the space. But you know, if 40 people showed up, we would have broke even. But it was this like insane, terrible like summer rainstorm the day of the screening, and I had been talking to Leonard Kinsey for a while at that point, and he had, you know, he tweeted out and put it on Facebook that we were doing the screening. And during the Q&A, where 25 people showed up, which means we lost a little bit of money on it. But during the Q&A, there was one guy who was there because of the tweet that that Leonard threw out there. And I mentioned this, that we were working together, collaborating to adapt his book. And this guy, like, lost his mind. He was so happy. It was really funny. It's really fun to work with, like, this sort of built-in audience already. Like,
oh, yeah.
When I did The Bubble, like, I had my audience of, like, friends and family. But now I have those people plus all of these people that came up from The Bubble, plus tapping into Leonard's, you know, community. It's been really exciting. And I'm really excited to see what's going to happen with this.
Wow, great. Yeah, I was going to ask you what you're doing next. I wasn't predicting this. I thought you were didn't think it was going to be Disney related at all. So
yeah, no, it's weird now. I was talking to my mom. I actually interviewed my mom about it over the Christmas holiday. I figured like Leonard could be sort of like the dark end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. if we're talking about the dark side. And then my mom, who is, you know, she's a mature adult who likes to go to the park by herself. She goes 3 or 4 times a year, often by herself, and still lives in Ohio. But she doesn't get crazy. Like, she likes to go to the Food and Wine Festival and have a glass of wine or two. But so she's like the light end of the spectrum. And so we can like even out the story with that. But she was like, this is it, I've done it. Like, she almost apologized because she was like, I've really passed on the Disney bug to you, just in a kind of a different way, I guess. So right. Yeah, the jokes now have been like, well, what's the trilogy going to be? What's the third film going to be?
Oh, wow. Well, I got some ideas, so I might pitch it.
yeah. Great. Excellent.
So if people want to watch The Bubble, how can they do it?
TheBubbleDocumentary.com is the URL. It is up there. You can, from there, you can get the film on Amazon. You can get it on video on demand through Amazon. It's like $1.99, and you can rent it for, you know, 48 hours or something. I think it's even like a 7-day rental. $1.99.
7 days.
Come on,
wow.
It's great. Yeah.
That's pennies a day, everybody.
Or you can own it for $4.99. And then they also, you can get it on DVD through there if you can't. If you don't want to, if you actually want to have a physical copy, you can get a DVD of it through Amazon. The links are at themobiledocumentary.com. I have run into some problems with people in England who really want to see the film, and the Amazon stuff doesn't work for them. And so I'm in the stages of getting the website updated to be able to stream it from the website. But until then, if anyone hears this and they're overseas and they want to see the film, just email me, like literally email me. And I've done this for so many people. Mm-hmm. I will send you a password protected copy of it, off of Vimeo. And there's a little tip jar, on Vimeo. So if you liked it, you can throw me a bone. And you can spread it around to people too. So,
oh, that's great. Well, there's a little prize or package for
international. If people sat through this whole podcast, they'll find that out. Just email me. I just want people to see it. So email me or contact me through the website, thebubbledocumentary.com, or my own personal filmmaking website is dearmothman.com. That's D-E-A-R and then Mothman. There's a whole story behind that, but I won't get into it.
Okay.
Hit me up. Anyone in the world can hit me up. And if you can't afford $1.99 and you live, you know, in America, I will send you a free link.
Excellent. So one last question I have for you is, have you heard any response from Disney about this documentary?
That's a great question. We live in a weird time because with that film Escape from Tomorrow came out last year, and it was a big Sundance hit just because of the fact that it was shot like on Disney property without any permits, features like Disney employees like in the background without permits.
Right.
Have you seen the movie by any
chance? I have seen Escape from Tomorrow. Yes.
Yeah, it's not the best movie, but it, because the story is a little weird and kind of goes off the rails, but. To their testament, they did a great job. Like they achieved something that no one really had achieved before, and it's now out there being distributed. Mm-hmm. And supposedly they've never heard from Disney.
Really?
Yeah. And so their theory, I've heard interviews with both the director and the actor. Their theory is that Disney doesn't care because at the end of the day, it's still like free press for Disney. It's the same thing, I think, that the guy, the CEO of HBO recently came out and somebody was like, well, don't you care that everyone's sharing like HBO Go logins?
Right.
And his statement was like, his literal statement was, I don't care because we're building an audience of addicts. Like, we're in the business of addiction and we want people to get hooked. And then maybe a year from now, we'll say, guess what? You have to pay. So with the bubble, it's interesting because I never heard a single thing from Disney. I never heard a blip. I also actually didn't reach out too much to Disney proper. Who I did reach out to was Lexan, who is the company that now is in charge of the town. They own the town and manage the town. And they were very funny because it was early on, I emailed them and said, hey, I'm making this documentary about the town. I would love to talk to a representative from Lexan. Let me know what I need to do to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And they quickly responded and they said, oh, hey, great to hear you're doing that. We will talk to people and see if they want to be involved in the film. Until then, you need to take down every single thing you have online about, you know, any footage you have about the town, any like reference to you making this movie. You have to take it all down.
Wow.
Because everything, yeah, their statement was that everything that you did is technically trespassing. Even though it's a public space, like the things you filmed are private property, they're homes and businesses, and you are technically trespassing. So you need to cease and desist. And so what's interesting about this is that they didn't actually send me a cease and desist order. They just told me to cease and desist, which is two different things. And also,
wow.
think about how many documentaries you've seen that involve like, you know, footage of in public space but of private buildings, say like the White House or the Empire State Building or things like that.
Yeah.
It's just there. It happens.
That was kind of BS, really. If you're standing on the street,
it was total BS.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what they did is they then sent me. I'm not gonna do that. But you know, what can we do to make this, you know, legal? And then they sent me a little like contract thing that basically took away. It was the silliest thing, because I don't know who in the right mind would have like just signed it and sent it back. But it basically took away all of my rights as a filmmaker. They basically said that they own the footage, and that I would also pay them like $5,000 a day for every day that I was shooting in Celebration.
Wow.
And the thing about it was that it technically was this weird contract that was looking at me as like a super big production, because there was even a whole section about like, if you have any sort of like explosions on the day of shooting, like
explosions.
I'm not coming there to like make the Avengers or anything. Like, I'm gonna be walking around with a DSLR, like, you know, shooting things. It's not gonna, you know, interfere with anyone's day. And so I think they were just trying to get some money out of me. It's what it sounded like they were doing, and then maybe just try to like, you know, squash the project through that. Right. So I did talk to a lawyer, and he was like, "Yeah, that's all garbage. Just keep doing what you're doing." And you know, legally, like I have release forms from all the subjects in the film, all the people I talked to. So that was the only thing I ever heard was from Lexan, and since then I haven't heard anything from anybody. So oddly enough, I just hear from mainly people in England for some reason who keep like saying, "Oh, I want to see this movie." Yeah, and so it's been nice. It's been a steady, since I released the film, it's been a nice little steady trickle coming in every month. And I haven't done like a ton of promotion for it, so that's why I'm happy to be on the Creepy Kingdom podcast with
you, James. Excellent. Yes. I'm happy to have you. I discovered you on Kickstarter. I was just searching for projects that had something to do with Disney, Disney fan projects. I didn't know I didn't find too much, and that's how I discovered it. And you were already funded, so I couldn't give you any money, but I did reach out to you.
Well, I'll hit you up in May. I think May is when we're going to try to kickstart this Dark Side of Disney thing.
Okay, right.
I'm actually going to Disney World. I think it's like April 12th and 13th. My wife is going to be speaking at a conference there. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get my mom to go also, and I want to get some footage of my mom hanging out as a, you know, mature adult at the park. I'm going to try to get a screening of the bubble there in Orlando. I think I may have burnt my bridges at Celebration, but I think there's definitely an audience for it. Obviously, there's an audience, like in Kissimmee, like show it at the. There's that one shot in the film in the Kissimmee segment of the Fawlty Towers Lounge or whatever it is, which is a bar, like a Fawlty Towers themed bar in Kissimmee. Like, that's awesome. That's where I want to screen my movie. I want to screen it.
Oh yeah, I thought that was weird when there was just a shot of it with no explanation in the film. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I was like, it's just like the weird TV oddities. Show?
Yeah,
yeah, just the weird stuff that's in Kissimmee. Kissimmee is a weird place. What I thought was funny was that all the other places are like completely abandoned except for the Fawlty Towers Lounge, which is a thriving business.
Well, let's make that happen. Yeah. Well, if it happens, I'll let the audience know.
And we're doing a screening in Baltimore too. That same week, I think we're looking. I don't want to say a date yet because we're still looking to lock it down. But sometime in middle of April, Leonard Kinsey is releasing a new book. And so we're going to go to Baltimore and do a screening of The Bubble and have a book signing of his new book and then kind of like publicly announce that we're making this documentary. So sometime soon after that, we're going to launch the Kickstarter. I think in May, we're going to do another Kickstarter for
it. I really want to try to make it to that. That seems like quite the media event there. That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm trying to get my friend who did the music for The Bubble there too. He lives in Akron, Ohio, but he did all the music for The Bubble, which I often say I think the music in the film is better than the film itself.
That's very good music.
And I sent him this long email that was like, "Hey, you should come, you know, Baltimore would be a great thing." And his only response was, "That's far." So,
well, it's about 4 hours for me. That seems like pretty exciting. I didn't know that. I don't know anything about Leonard's new book either. So, do you know what it is?
Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about his thing, but yeah, it sounds awesome. I'm really excited about it. His first fictional book, Our Kingdom of Dust, is definitely worth reading. I really enjoyed it. It's about a guy who is, you know, just goes through some terrible things in life and ends up kind of like sneaking off to Disney World to like live his life at the park, like, you know, living in a hotel there, and gets into some weird stuff. His next book sounds even better. I'm really excited to read it.
Oh, so it's fiction. Yeah, Our Kingdom of Dust is great. I definitely enjoyed that. And right now I'm reading a book that he didn't write, but that he released, which is Hollow World, which I just...
Reading it right now. I'm reading it too. It's really interesting. I was saying to my wife that I think it's so interesting that these books, they spend a lot of time being like really accurate about the geography of right. Disney World. Like they really like, it's almost like this weird, like, you know, like form of pornography where they're like, yeah. So then I took a left out the door and then took a right and was on that hidden path that goes in Epcot Center. And people that are like in the know are like, oh yeah, I know exactly where that path is.
Right. Cause if they didn't do that, then it would be like, oh, this is crap. You know, they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So that's why they do these real fine details.
yeah, definitely. People would flip out. Cool. Yeah.
All righty. Well, thank you for coming on, and we'll catch up.
Yeah, thanks, James.
Again, sometime in the future.
Definitely. Yeah. Good luck with everything, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks again to Philip Swift for coming on the show and talking all about his documentary, The Bubble. I will have the Amazon links in the show notes for this episode, episode 9. Those are affiliate links, so we do get some pennies if you go through us. We'd appreciate it. But like Philip said, if you can't afford the $1.99, you can contact him on his website, thebubbledocumentary.com, and he said he would send you a password-protected link. So what do you think about that, huh? I'll definitely keep you posted on upcoming screenings of The Bubble, and of course, on the film in development, the very exciting news that was announced on this show, the Dark Side of Disney documentary. That is just in its infant stages, as he said, and we talked a little more about it after we recorded, and this is going to be epic. So that's not the last you've heard of Philip Swift on this show, I can tell you that much. So if you would like to get in touch with me, it's easy, creepykingdom@gmail.com, and you can check out our website for show notes, like I just mentioned. Videos, creepy Disney fan art, cosplay, pictures, links to all our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube. It's all there. All you got to remember, creepykingdom.com. We are, of course, available in the iTunes store, where you can leave us a review, preferably a 5-star review. It would be incredibly awesome of you to do so. I would appreciate the feedback, and it also lets other people know about the show so we can grow our own creepy kingdom here. Let's grow it. Let's grow the kingdom. Let's leave a review. I mean, I'm not going to review my own show. That's a little tacky. But you can do it. So why not? Right on. And of course, we are available on the Stitcher application. Stitcher, the app that streams podcasts directly to your smartphone. No downloading. All you gotta do is search Creepy Kingdom, add it to the playlist, and you'll never miss an episode. Well, until next time,
keep it creepy.
I have a girl now. It's midnight. Pleasant dreams. Ha 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 ha
Ha ha ha ha!